Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey for Reality Check Radio. And welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to join you again, as always.
And we've got a really great mix of international and local issues this week. We may even go 50-50. I'm not sure. I may as well just get going with it. And very late last week, which we weren't able to cover in our roundup, was the endorsement of RFK Jr. for Donald Trump. And that's, I think, the biggest development in the US election. And I guess it would be great to get your thoughts on that, even though it's a week old news now almost. Do you think it's impacted the race? Has it affected the energy of the election? And do you think it's going to impact the outcome?
It'll have an impact. I think it'll have a positive impact, but I'm a little bit uncertain. So we have to remember that RFK Jr. traditionally has been on the Democratic side of politics. Although he's an independent now, many of the traditional Democratic causes he has been known to support in the past. I think one of Trump's real weaknesses going into this election has been on vaccines and the COVID pandemic, because Trump actually did the deal with the vaccine companies, the big pharmaceutical companies.
Operation Warp Speed was his idea. Yeah.
And although he made good noises and said the right things about not mandating the vaccines and things like that, he was responsible for giving them a whole bunch of money for rolling out the vaccines to everyone, promoting it. And he, even to this day, still tries to take credit for it. And RFK Jr. is a long-time vaccine skeptic. He's very critical of the pharmaceutical companies. And I think this sort of endorsement or teaming up or whatever we want to make of it will help alleviate some of the perhaps lingering concern that some people have over the vaccine and the COVID pandemic issue. So it helps Trump on that front. There's also been some talk around Tulsi Gabbard coming into the campaign and some support there as well. So this is Trump style himself more as a centrist, the purple Trump, of some people have called it, where he's looking to get. So Tulsi Gabbard and RFK Jr. are Democratic, kind of Democratic, kind of left-wing voices, but they're still outsider. They're sort of rogue Democrats or Democrats who are outside the Democratic establishment. What Trump appears to be doing here is setting up a new kind of political center in American politics that is anti-establishment, I guess you could say. And there's a lot of appetite for that. And I think that's quite exciting too. I mean, I would love it if politics in America had anti-establishment candidates on both the left and right. And that's what the elections were. But the great worry is that it means Trump's going soft on some of his traditional issues, especially around immigration. He's being criticized actually from the people on his right flank, people like Nick Fuentes, who was a big supporter in earlier Trump campaigns, now criticizing him for going soft on immigration and various other things. And Trump has made comments that suggest he's taking a softer approach to immigration. So there's some real concern there. So that's the trade-off. I think he's trying to distance himself from some of the harsher right-wing voices and set himself up as more as an anti-establishment centrist candidate.
And you can see that on conservative issues as well. He's signaled or counter-signaled the pro-life movement in the past week, especially, as has J.D. Vance. So there's a lot of these, sometimes we refer to them as the pro-life industrial complex, but basically the people who are influencers and make a lot of money off the pro-life movement, they're coming out and harshly criticizing Trump as well, and saying that maybe they won't vote for him anymore because they see that he's going soft on the issues that they care about. So it'll be fascinating to watch this develop, because getting very, very close to the finish line here, and we still haven't had any interviews done by Kamala Harris. They haven't done any debates yet. So it's strange to sort of be this close to the end and yet all of the good stuff, basically, in terms of what's going to happen in the US election is still to come. And then you look back just over the last month and you think, wow, there's a lot of stuff that did happen. Even the attempted assassination of Trump was just over a month ago. I think we're coming up to 6 weeks now, but it may not even be that long. You obviously had Kamala Harris swapped out. It's been a very wild ride, and I expect that to continue.
Yeah, I mean, say what you want about Trump. If nothing else, he's made American politics more entertaining. And in some ways, perhaps that's a really good thing. It gets more people engaged in politics, perhaps encourages more people to vote.
And it's great for the pundits like us, the commentators, because there's always something to talk about. Now, if we go across the Atlantic to the dark European continent, there's been some very troubling news out of Europe this week as well. And in particular, the arrest of Pavel Durov, the founder and CEO of Telegram in France. So he has French citizenship, actually. I was surprised to see that. He was born in Russia, Russian citizenship, French citizenship. He lives in the United Arab Emirates, so he's got UAE citizenship as well. And when he recently arrived in France, he was arrested. Many people will have heard this already. And the charges they placed on him were basically that he was running a platform on which criminal activity was taking place, and that he refused to basically give a backdoor to intelligence agencies to be able to decrypt what potentially would be possibly criminal activity. So obviously that is a very strange accusation to make, a very strange basis to make these arrests, because this would open up basically everyone who runs a social media company, everyone who runs a platform of some sort could be arrested if these standards were being applied. And they even accused him of practicing cryptography without a license, which apparently is a thing in France. You have to have special permission to engage in cryptography. And it's just been revealed, though, later on in this week, that he was maybe invited to France by Emmanuel Macron. He was invited for dinner, perhaps, and essentially lured into a trap where they could arrest him, because he doesn't really spend any time in France at all, I believe. So that's been an interesting development. Even a possible diplomatic incident with the UAE. Kim.com revealed that there was a $17 billion arms deal that the UAE had put on pause with France. A number of fighter jets, I believe, they were supposed to be ordering in. And I've seen that confirmed in the mainstream media in the Middle East, but there still seems to be some fog there around what the full implications of this arrest are, because everyone can see the charges are bogus, basically. So there's big concern from different governments and from different CEOs running platforms. So Elon Musk has voiced his concern. The CEO of Rumble has also announced that he's fled Europe. Basically, he doesn't trust that the same thing could happen to him. So he doesn't trust any of the European governments at the moment. And I'm not sure where he's relocated himself to, but he's definitely decided to fly the coup.
Well, yeah, the Europeans, there's been a lot of noises about censorship of social media coming out of Europe for a while now. And while this is something we get in every country, so you get the feeling, though it's the feeling you get from afar, that this push for censorship is stronger in Europe than it is in many of the perhaps Anglosphere countries that we're in. And that's worrying. Telegram is a true free speech app. It's an app, a social media device that a lot of the more dissident voices use. When everything was heavily censored on X, there are a lot of dissident voices on Telegram. And it's become one of the best sources of unfiltered information for the Ukraine war, for example. It enables people on both sides to get information about what's really going on the ground there, because both the Russian side and the European side are, you know, selective and deceptive even in the way they cover things there. So it has real utility as an app, and it has proven itself to be an effective free speech app, an effective alternative if when X wasn't promoting free speech in the same way. What I find interesting is we've had these revelations about the Twitter files now for a long time, and people can see that, you know, intelligence agencies are working for and working with that they're intimately intertwined with these social media companies. You've got people in the government, in the intelligence agencies, basically ringing them up, telling them, oh, can you censor this guy? Can you censor that guy? And the social media apps are basically doing it. So when they're asking for a backdoor into a Telegram to deal with some of the, you know, malicious content on here, no one can have any faith that they're really going to stick to, you know, terrorist activity or things like that. They're going to censor voices they don't like, because that's what they've been doing across all these other apps. So this is just a complete beat up. It's, I mean, it's strongman politics. It's thuggery, really, isn't it? You didn't do what we want you to do, so now we're going to make your life difficult and punish you. And it's terrible. I just hope something changes that we can get through this.
Yeah, he revealed in an interview with Tucker Carlson a few months ago now that when he was last in America, or one of his engineers was in America, that the CIA tried to bribe him to help them put a backdoor into Telegram. Like, that's the level of shenanigans that's going on that he's revealed already. And obviously you've got governments complaining that, yeah, there's criminal activity on Telegram, but that's the same problem that all of these other social media companies have, and they have it even worse, right? Like, you don't have free speech on Facebook, but all kinds of criminal activity shows up in you know, whenever there's reports on what level of organized crime or just terrible situations that are being exploited, people being exploited. It's Facebook, it's TikTok, it's Instagram, and Snapchat, I think, are the ones that come up in terms of being the worst for complete predatory behavior and exploitative behavior and criminality of the worst kind. And these are all platforms that censor free speech. If you have the wrong political opinions, you get banned from those platforms. And so the governments are perfectly happy with them, even though there's all of this absolutely horrific criminal activity that's common there. And then when it comes to Telegram, it's the one platform that's been complete free speech platform the whole time. And then you get governments complaining, oh, hey, there's content we don't like on there. Initially, it was the Russian government saying, oh, people criticizing the Russian government. And you've got the Israeli government saying, oh, there's people being anti-Semitic on Telegram. And then these European governments switching gear and saying, oh, it's the criminal stuff. We'll go and get them on the criminal stuff. Of course, it's false pretenses, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's just a drive by these intelligence agencies and governments for more and more control all the time. We need to control things more. We need to control the opinions that people are saying more. We need to control people's behavior more. And I mean, that type of attitude and behavior followed through to its logical conclusion. It really strips human beings of their agency and their ability to choose things that differ from what the people in charge want them to do. It removes freedom of choice. So even if you may end up legally still having free choice, if in reality the information you're being given is so controlled, and that the choice architecture, they call it, the incentives you're facing for the choices you make is so structured that you're only realistically going to choose to do what the people in charge want you to do anyway, effectively you don't have freedom, even though legally you still might. And that's the real problem here. There's something wrong with a highly managerial approach to power and control and governance, especially now that we have these tools like the internet that enables such great levels of control and manipulation of human behavior. There's something incredibly dangerous about that.
And to the listeners, I just want to be clear as well that Telegram does comply with police orders, or when there's criminal activity, then the police of any country can basically put in an order, or a court can put in an order, and Telegram will comply with those and provide the information and work with the authorities where legal issues are at play. And I know this from Andrew Torba, who's the CEO of Gab, which is another free speech platform as well. He's always very clear and open about this, that he operates under US law. He operates under the First Amendment. When the police come and give an order and say, hey, we're doing a criminal investigation, here's a crime, here's the court order, can you hand over this particular information? He's always very open. He says, then he complies with police, gives you the information he's legally required to give. He will always publicly post about this as well. So, hey, the police have made requests about, you know, these potential criminal behaviors that are ongoing. We're going to make sure we stamp that out. And obviously, that doesn't insulate him at all from people trying to shut him down, because the reason they're trying to shut him down has got nothing to do with criminal behavior potentially happening on the platform, because obviously the police can do proper investigations, can get proper court orders, and people are happy to comply. No, it's all this nefarious behind the scenes. You need to be giving us access to do what we want. We want to be able to send you text messages to say, hey, shut down this account, shut down that account, without going through any kind of a legal process. And that's something that Andrew Torba has been very vocal in opposing. That's something that Pavel Durov has been very vocal in opposing, and they've held the line on this. And obviously when it came to Twitter, when it came to Facebook, they were just complying with this. And Elon Musk taking over Twitter, he has started to hold the line on this as well. He started to make it very clear where he stands on this. And interestingly, and I just mentioned this in my chat with Shelby before, Mark Zuckerberg has come out now and said that, hey, he was pressured by the Biden administration, was pressured to censor people during COVID, pressured to censor Hunter Biden laptop story. And the government did this through all of these back channels, and Facebook at the time complied. And he's now publicly saying that that's what they did, and they did it because they were pressured by the government. And I don't believe he fully apologized, but he's at least, seems somewhat remorseful in this, in making this public. And so that we know for sure, we knew that it was happening anyway, but we have his complete confirmation now that yes, this was going on. There was no conspiracy. It was all just the truth.
Yeah, well, I think everyone sort of knew already that this was the sort of thing that was going on, because we'd heard the revelations, as we've been talking about, with all these other social media companies. So, I mean, everyone, I think, knew that it was endemic, and he's just told us now and confirmed it.
And I mentioned the Rumble CEO fleeing Europe. I thought an interesting subject around immigration that we could quickly talk about, since we love talking about immigration. The final issue that we have in Europe, and I saw, and perhaps people who are interested in immigration will see this as a positive, there is one country in Europe that's seeing high levels of immigration. People are leaving the country. People are going back to their countries of origin, and that country is Sweden. And there have been several large reports on why people have been leaving Sweden. And they seem to have a few things that they've basically changed in their system. One is that they've stopped chain migration, which is very common. And I think it's very common here. I'll let you explain what chain migration is at the moment. But basically, they've stopped chain migration. And a lot of people are deciding, you know what, I'd rather live with my family and friends back home. And after a while of living in Sweden, they go back home. And then another thing that they have are resettlement bonuses, basically cash incentives for people to go back to the country that they came from, usually refugees. So things have quieted down a little bit, and Sweden is actually offering cash, like $1,000, $2,000 or whatever, to help people relocate back to the country that they came from. And both of this seems to be quite successful. And I think it's important just to mention this in the context of immigration, as we're always talking about, that there are very peaceful and positive ways to resolve the problems of immigration in a way that is actually beneficial to everyone involved.
Yeah, you've talked about remigration on your program before, and people have a tendency to think that this is a scary concept that might involve the violation of people's human rights. And I think it's important to point out where there's an example that shows that it's not like that at all. All you really need to do is change the incentives for coming into the country and leaving the country. And if you do that enough, you will start to get some of the people who probably shouldn't have been invited into the country to start with, who are causing problems like crime, division, terrorism, ethnic conflict in these countries. If you restructure the incentives, as Sweden has done, and many of these people will leave voluntarily. And this is an example of it happening successfully. So effectively, they're paying people to leave. And well, that's one of the things that they're doing anyway. And people might object to that on the face of it, and I probably would object to that on the face of it as well. But when you think it through, you see that, especially if you're a significant welfare state like Sweden, if these people stay in the country, they're going to be costing a lot of money to the taxpayer anyway. They'll be costing money in terms of welfare benefits, in terms of crime, just in terms of the consumption of ordinary social services that most ordinary Swedes consume. And so they're being paid money by the state anyway. So instead of being paid money to stay, why not pay them money to leave? And then you might actually save yourself money in the long run. So I think this is a very positive policy. It's important to point out where you have examples of success. They've also restructured the regulations on bringing people in, like you mentioned, chain migration. So you can't get in and then bring in all your family members and your extended family as well. I think that's positive. I mean, that it sort of goes against the whole idea. You want, when you're bringing in immigration like that, you want to be filling skill shortages and things like that. You don't want to be bringing in whole clans, whole tribes of people from whatever region they're coming in from. So
yeah,
yes,
that's something I can speak to as an immigrant myself, and that my parents, like, they moved here as a family by themselves, knowing that this was going to be a new place where they were starting a new life. And it wasn't like, oh great, once we're here, once, you know, then we'll go and like exploit the system and like get, you know, our extended family and drag them in here and like colonize a neighborhood and, you know, with our extended family. Like, that's the kind of thing that happens with chain migration, and people complain about it all the time. But the reason it happens is because it's legal. Like, the government basically just incentivizes people to do this. It's complete madness.
Well, I mean, there is somewhat of a reason for, I mean, family unification, keeping families together. I think it's not altogether unreasonable, but mostly it is unreasonable. If you look at the results in terms of the large numbers of people, many of whom not having the skills or the backgrounds being the types of immigrants you would want to bring in, you're not subjecting them to a rigorous screening program that you really ought to be doing is the problem.
Yeah, well, if you want, you know, the family to be reunited, you can always go back to where you come from. You know, I've actually got a family member who did that recently, moved back to country and, you know, back to be with different parts of the family. So it happens all the time, you know, and there's not necessarily the burden is on, say, New Zealand to reunite families from immigrants who have moved here, because it can come at a very significant cost to New Zealand, especially we see this with say older migrants who maybe require lots of health care, and we already have so many problems with our health system. So something that New Zealand really should be thinking about a lot more. And it's just great to see the success story in Sweden, that it's working well and it doesn't actually cause any problems, and it's not scary for a country to kind of change its immigration system, to change the incentives in a way that will be more beneficial for the country itself. Well, with that, we'll move on to our next part of the world, which is going to be Australia, and a little bit connected to New Zealand, I guess. But we've had a lot of noise around a planned trip by Candace Owens to Australia. And I think the trip will be cancelled. I don't know if it's been formally cancelled yet, but it sounds like the Australian government has basically said, no, she's not allowed to come into the country, which sounds kind of final to me. But there may still be other elements that, like, maybe the ministers themselves of, you know, the Labour Party ministers and the Australian government can't actually block her directly. So we'll still have to wait and see how that works. It's unlikely that she would come to New Zealand if she were blocked from Australia. It's usually we're a bit too far out of the way. But there's been a lot of noise around this. So perhaps you can fill the audience in on what exactly the complaints have been about Candace Owens.
The main complaint seems to be that she has expressed skepticism about certain elements of the Holocaust or the mainstream Holocaust narrative. I don't think it's wholesale Holocaust denial, but like there's aspects she's questioned in her shows in various times. And of course, there's a very large and loud and vocal lobby that defends the Holocaust narrative in most Western countries. David Irving is a famous Holocaust denier. He was famously one of the very few people denied a visa to come and talk in New Zealand. And I realize it's a very sensitive subject, but it's basically the logic of free speech applies just the same in this case as in any other case. Holocaust denial is just an opinion, a position that people take on a historical event, namely that it didn't happen, or aspects of it didn't happen, or the aspects of it are exaggerated. And this should be treated like any other hypothesis or any other opinion or view or theory about a historical event that happened and investigated and debated rationally. We don't need to be censoring people or blocking them from coming into countries or otherwise making their lives miserable because they have opinions that are unusual.
Yeah, people are allowed to have different opinions. People are even allowed to be wrong. And it's not like the government's job to determine I'm sorry, but you're wrong, and so you're not allowed to come into our country.
That's right.
And but actually, I think maybe if I push back on you a little bit more to say, okay, what about causing the disturbance in the country? You know, and they're going to be violent protests, and people are going to get hurt, and It's going to increase the amount of anti-Semitic or anti-Muslim crime and the hate crimes in the country. That's the argument, right?
I think part of the problem is if you make such a big deal out of it to begin with, if you turn Holocaust denial into a great big scary thing, it sort of sensitizes people to it and makes them more likely to protest and become violent when that taboo is violated. So, I mean, this whole narrative around getting extra sensitive and banning things and making things taboo and off limits, I'm not sure that whole narrative that tamps down conflict rather than stirs it up. I'm not sure people have that the right way around.
And Australia has been in the news for one other crazy thing, this one, the most crazy of them all. There was a court case called Tickle versus Giggle. Perhaps you can tell us, or I don't know if that was the name of the court case, but it's what people have been calling it. Perhaps you can fill us in a little bit on the details and why it's so outrageous.
Yeah, well, Giggle is a women's only app. It's an app for women to network and set up women's only spaces, women's get-togethers, various things, but it's women's only. And this trans woman called someone Tickle, funny name, went on the app and said, well, I'm a woman, you know, I'm a trans woman, trans women are women, I'm going on the app too. And she or he got booted off because they said, well, you're not a woman, you're a man. And then she went to court claiming discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Now, from all reports, the actual quality of legal argumentation in the case from both sides was very poor. But the result has been that basically the court have sided with the trans woman and said, yes, this is a case of discrimination on the basis of gender identity, and she needs to be allowed onto the app. And so there's been, you know, various fines and stuff, compensation, whatever, that's been paid out as a result. But the real problem here is there's a conflict between the rights of biological women and the rights of trans women. They want mutually exclusive things, and they both can't have what they want. So women obviously want women's only spaces, they want women's toilets, they want their own sports division, etc. And that seems fairly reasonable. There's fairly good reasons why if women want to play sport, if they play sport, if men are allowed into their sports teams too, then that's not really going to be fair because men have huge biological advantages. And there's good reasons to keep men out of the women's toilet as well, like so they can't be preyed on, sexually abused, so they can be kept safe, etc. So you can't satisfy both of those wants at once. And you really have to pick whose side you're going to be on. And what this case shows is that if you can defeat, if you can subvert, if you can undermine the definition of woman, for example, or the definition of whom various other rights apply to, it's a way of stripping people's rights away. And so I think the thing to be wary of here, and the thing to keep an eye out for and make sure that doesn't happen in future, is that this tactic of undermining the type of person or the definition or the group of people that a right applies to isn't done in a bunch of other circumstances as well, because that would be an effective way of undermining people's rights.
Well, I think this is the natural end of sort of equality and anti-discrimination legislation, where you can't discriminate on the basis of sex or gender identity or whatever they want to make up. But you could theoretically have had, say, a man make the same objection to say, oh, you can't have an app that's just for women because I'm a man, and you're discriminating against men. And of course, this would have been done the other way around by the early feminists, you know, pushing for greater equality to say, oh, you can't exclude women from this club because you know, you're discriminating on the basis of sex. So it seems like we are at a point where the natural end of anti-discrimination legislation, the natural end of equality, is sort of being reached in this very bizarre way. And you can see the people should be upset, and this shouldn't happen, but it probably needs to spark a broader discussion around discrimination, the fact that it's actually a good thing for people to be allowed to discriminate to a degree, to be able to set up spaces where they can, you know, exclude people that they disagree or don't want to interact with, and restore a greater freedom of association, because that's basically what you have in conflict, right? You have a supposed right to association, but at the same time, you don't have a right to discriminate. You have anti-discrimination legislation, and that's coming into a big conflict here. You said the arguments were not argued very well from a legal case. Perhaps there'll be some appeal or some other case to undo the craziness. But at the same time, I look at this and I think, well, that's the craziness is the rational end of these two so-called rights coming into conflict, because you can't have both as freedom of association and anti-discrimination / equality as a legal right as well.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that was the big conflict when civil rights laws, the African-American civil rights movement in the US, the Jim Crow laws were overturned, is that it takes away people's freedom of association, because the right to exclude certain people from your business or to not hire them is actually implied and part of freedom of association. So you have to choose whether you want to have freedom of association or require inclusion, which is the idea that you can't choose in all circumstances who you associate with. And you're right. I mean, it is, there are good reasons to choose not to associate with certain people, or to have zones, or, you know, areas or situations where you only want certain types of people and not others. And I think the women's toilet, the women's changing room is an obvious example of that. But it's not the only one. There are lots of situations like that where you only want certain types of people. You should be able to have a men's group. You should be able to have, you know, a men's holiday group, men's whatever. It was something we used to have, and it's sort of been set up as discriminatory now. And people grouping together on the basis of things you have in common is actually kind of the basis of all human interaction. So when you're not allowed to do that, or you're prevented from excluding people who don't have the thing in common, it kind of sets you back and makes you unable to sort of associate with people and get along with people in the normal way.
All right, and it is time, with the time that we have left, to look at some local issues. We've definitely had a lot of international things to get through, but we will continue here right in New Zealand. And the one I want to touch on first, I think, continues a little bit of this, the issues around freedom of speech and association even, but it's a little bit of a strange one, because we had a brewery here, Te Aro Brewery, who were stung by the Advertising Standards Association, that they had been advertising beer, or they'd even created beer just simply as a product with explorers as a theme. And one of the great explorers they put on this, in addition to, say, Christopher Columbus, they put Kupe on there, the famous Maori explorer who discovered New Zealand. And they were told that they weren't allowed to use Kupe on the beer, because that was offensive to Maori, and it diminished the mana of Kupe and all of his descendants. What do you think about this ruling, and what does it mean for New Zealand? Because I think it has some very strange implications as well.
Well, I think they're being very precious. It wasn't really inherently a discriminatory or demeaning to Kupe. It was just a beer with Kupe on it.
Well, I thought it was a positive thing, actually.
Yeah, I mean, they're celebrating getting Maori culture out there a bit more. So yeah, I mean, this is silly, but I guess the underlying principle here is they want Maori historical, you know, great figures to have some sort of a sacred element, that you have to be very careful and treat them carefully. I guess that's the underlying urge here.
But it implies ownership of the past, effectively, right? You can't talk about the past or use it in a certain context and use history and historical figures because they're owned by someone else.
Yeah, no, I agree. That doesn't make sense. You can't do that. And it's not applied consistently, obviously, because they're not doing that for figures from, you know, European culture or any other culture.
No, but we would think it completely strange. I mean, I suspect that all the Maori that I know think this is insane as well. But I'm wondering who's the target audience here? Like, who are the people who are complaining and that they're appeasing? Because you think about any European figure, nobody owns that. Even the accusation that, oh, well, Maori have been harmed by alcohol, and so having something from Maori culture associated with alcohol. Like, I don't know, think about like Irish culture. Irish culture is associated with alcohol, and they've been harmed very much by alcohol. Like, it doesn't hold up. You can't apply it consistently anywhere, and nobody would even think to claim ownership of the culture, like it's because it's a government agency, basically, or is it a quasi-government agency that's effectively claiming that it can rule that you're not allowed to use certain historical figures?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's bizarre. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the status of the Advertising Standards Authority is. I'd imagine some sort of quasi-government agency. I mean, it'd have kind of statutory powers if it's, you know, passing like legal judgments on what's allowed and what's not. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. This is just silly. We can't have this sort of stuff going on.
It's a form of paternalism where they're trying to protect, like acting like this part of the population is infantile and they need to be protected against bad things. And a lot of that is being applied at a really weird scale. I wish I had something more to say about it, but I don't really know how to completely express what I think about this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, neither do I. I mean, it's silly. I don't know why they're doing it. You're right. They're trying to treat this as if it's really sacred and you can't do it. It's not applied consistently across other cultures. Most Maori group would agree, I think, that this is silly as well. We don't need to be so precious about this. What's the deal here, Advertising Standards Authority?
Mm-hmm. And perhaps it's worth asking if there's a solution to this. Is there something that the government can do and should be doing to basically beat some sense into the ASA? Because, and this should apply to basically any of these other agencies that have statutory power, who are planning to make decisions like this in the future, this is probably something the government has to act on if it's going to nip it in the bud. Perhaps it may have to do with who gets appointed to these associations, or perhaps they've been infiltrated by far-left activists. That seems to be perhaps the most likely scenario. I haven't had a look at who's actually on the authority who's making these decisions, but perhaps it is just a case of far-left extremists infiltrating these organizations and getting themselves to the top so that they can make these insane decisions.
You know, it does seem like a rather extreme case of a tendency that exists in other government departments and in other organizations of being really precious about Maori culture. Mm-hmm. And, I think you should be, you should treat it with respect, but this is sort of going too far. And
it seems like the reason why it's so offensive even to me is that the brewery was treating it with respect. They did something very respectful, something very positive. When I first saw it, I thought, oh, yes, this is a very positive thing. And then I read the headline and the details, and I was angry even that this was being viewed in such a negative way.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say except that I'm agreeing with him. But
that's fine. Let's move on to the next thing to get angry about. And it's along similar lines, because you had a pamphlet in Wellington that was supposed to be delivered by the post office, and you had posties refusing to deliver this pamphlet that was warning Wellington residents about the call to prayer from mosques that could be broadcast. And perhaps you're, being from that area, may be more familiar with the details. But again, I have heard about this, but the Wellington Council is basically saying that the mosque call to prayer could be publicly broadcast at some point in the near future. And you've got a protest group that paid for the post office to deliver these flyers to people, and then you had posties refuse to do it. I think, thankfully, the post office and the union all said, no, actually, you do have to deliver the mail. You actually have a legal requirement to deliver the mail, and you can't just protest. So it happened. But again, same kind of activity, people getting very precious about this, something that they thought was offensive, and decided to make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing here is there's no recognition from the posties about the subjectivity of the situation. The reason that the people are mailing out the pamphlet in the first place is because they find the idea of the Muslim call to prayer being broadcast throughout their neighborhood to be offensive, and they want to take the normal legal democratic steps to raise awareness of it and try and head it off democratically. That's what you're supposed to do. What do you want people to do? And so it seems like the posties are only looking at this, they're looking at it in a very one-sided way. They're siding completely on the side of the Muslim communities and saying, just like we see the mainstream media do every day, if you're on this side of this debate, then you're hateful and bigoted and far right and whatever else. But if you're on this side of the people, then you're on the side of the angels. Your opinions are good and tolerant and liberal and all the nice words. So, I mean, that's just, there seems to be people who are just unable to see both sides of issues like that. They're all on one side. And I just think it's obvious that having the Muslim prayer broadcast in your neighborhood, if you're not a Muslim, is kind of annoying. and people have every right to protest against it. If you have Muslim prayer in Muslim countries, that kind of makes sense to me. Like, it's a different country, it has different rules, it has different religion, it has different norms. That's the way they do things here. In New Zealand, we're not a Muslim country, and there's no reason why everyone else should have to put up with that.
I think you mean to say we're not a Muslim country yet, and that's maybe part of the part of the plan. But let's move on. Let's move on to one last free speech issue. Shane Jones in Parliament referred to a judge as a communist, and that angered the opposition. I called for him to apologize and so on. But it turns out that this judge that he called a communist is actually a communist, or was a communist perhaps several decades ago. It's hard to know if she still is. But that does raise worrying issue of how we're getting communists onto our benches, professed communists as judges. That should be the thing that we should be worried about. But no, instead, Shane Jones has been accused of breaching the cabinet manual and not respecting the judiciary. So what do you think? Is this a case of the judiciary being disrespected, or is this a case of New Zealanders being disrespected by the judiciary?
Probably more the latter. I'm not familiar with exactly what the cabinet manual says in this case. There are good reasons, when everything's functioning normally, for their respect to be shown from elected representatives towards members of the judiciary. And so there's good reasons for that, and under any normal situation that ought to be respected. What's going on here is that the judiciary are being disrespectful in many of the things that they're doing to New Zealand. And many of the decisions that are being made are not legitimate attempts to interpret what the law says, but are attempts to decide what they think the law ought to say and make that the decision that they're handing down. And we're seeing this across numerous areas. We're seeing it with the stuff that's coming out of the Waitangi Tribunal on Maori decisions. We're seeing this in stuff to do with the tranny stuff on a whole bunch of civil rights issues. We've seen this for, you know, 50 years. Judges have an agenda. They have a what would you call it, a liberal, a civil rights, a DEI agenda. They've been ramming through across all Western countries. It goes against what ordinary people want, and yet they're doing it anyway. You have to be able to call them out. If this person really was a communist, you should be able to use a correct descriptive term to refer to them as that. Otherwise, you're really making criticism or even accurate descriptions off limits in order to protect the judiciary from appropriate and needed criticism. What makes this even more ironic is that, you know, we're having ordinary people now demonized as, you know, far right and violent extremists if they think men are men or women are women and you can't change from one to the other, and all sorts of normal views. If you've got the normal religious view around sticking up for traditional marriage, for example, then you're a far right hateful bigot for that. If you don't want mass immigration coming into your country, where you're a racist, then you're xenophobic for that. All these issues, people are demonized unfairly if they have normal opinions of being far right, violent extremists, racist, sexist, homophobic bigots. And people throw those terms around with gay abandon, and they do real damage to people. You can lose your job, lose your friends, you suffer serious damage to your reputation from those terms. And this judge can't take being called a communist. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you need to harden up. If you are a communist, you should be able to be called one.
That's right. So, by the way, I should clarify, we're referring to the High Court Justice Cheryl Gwynne, and she was actually a member of the Trotskyist Socialist Action League. So,
definitely not a communist then. So, yeah, you can see how unfair that label is.
Trotskyist and a socialist, not a communist. And was a member 40 years ago. I suspect she has not really changed her views, perhaps just decided to be a little bit less loud about them until she reached the top levels of the judiciary. And unfortunately, that's the state of the country. A very, very sad, negative thing to be in the state where some of your top judges are communists. That is the real outrage.
Yeah.
Now, moving to a slightly different branch of the government almost, well, it's not quite, but the New Zealand police had a report released that they were engaging in systemic bias. And this is related to an issue we talked about last week, where you had the AUT Dean of Law, Kylie Quince. I believe she was involved in authoring that report. And so that, of course, raises some other issues, I guess, around the criticism of the police in this case, or the people who are authoring reports into the police. Again, very suspect people who have very radically far-left biases.
Yeah, well, I mean, systemic bias is mostly fake and made up.
And I think it's completely fake and made up, actually.
Well, what's going on here is that some groups are committing more crime than others, but they don't want to admit that. So they say, well, the reason it looks like people are committing more crime and they're getting arrested more often is because the police are secretly racist. They're unconsciously racist. They're racist, no matter even if they're trying overtly to be not racist, no matter if they've got policies in place and everyone's following them not to be racist. Still, they're unconsciously biased way back here in the back of your head. And there's nothing you can do to get out of that. I mean, this is the same sort of stuff that Freud used to do. He used to have these unverifiable hypotheses about why people did the things that they do. There's nothing you can do to falsify these claims. They're just sort of unscientific, unverifiable slanders that are being used to explain away an inconvenient empirical fact about reality, which is that groups of people aren't always the same. Some commit more crimes than others. It might not go along with your idea of equality, but we have to be honest about these things and design policies that work given the nature of reality, rather than denying it, trying to construct these elaborate ways of hiding reality, or these sort of reverse discrimination measures to try and find ways of locking up more white people or arresting more white people to sort of even it out, some sort of, communism, justice system somehow.
Well, the Labour government had a kind of, they weren't that brazen and bold. They did sort of thought they'd tackle it from the other end, right? They had a plan to empty the prisons. They said, well, we have too many people, I think it was in particular Maori men who are in prison, too many of them in prison as a percentage of the population. So we just let them out. Which is like decrease the prison population and let them out of prison. And what happened is crime spiked, crime went up. And I see the National Party is bragging now about how they've managed to reduce crime and the police are actively working to arrest criminals again. But yeah, that's the situation that you end up in, right? And if you were to follow the systemic bias report, well, the obvious answer is, okay, well, we just need to say, okay, yeah, what's the color of your skin? We're not going to arrest you. We're not going to put you into prison. Or if you are in prison, well, we're going to let you out to kind of balance out the numbers. And at the end of the day, there's no concern about systemic bias against the innocent, ordinary people of New Zealand by these academics.
Yeah, and that's no one ever takes account of the negative effects of the policies on that end. Obviously, if you're putting less criminals in prison, they're going to be out on the streets committing more crimes and hurting more innocent people. And that's really that's the major thing that you should be trying to stop, crimes against innocent people, not sort of inequalities within the justice system. That's a secondary consideration.
Okay, we are basically out of time today, but I'd like to finish with something more positive. I will select the most positive of the items I had left listed here, and I think that's going to be to get your thoughts on the phase two terms of reference for the COVID inquiry. So what are your overall thoughts on what's been announced from the government? I think on the whole, Reality Check Radio is happy to have had some of their wins, some of our targets, some of the issues that we've been pushing for included in here. So I think the new terms of reference are quite positive, but there's probably a little bit of, there's some stuff that we'll be missing, but it'd be great to get your thought on those.
Well, the big positive is that they're going to look into the efficacy and whether they were good decisions were made around having mandates, lockdowns, and vaccine safety and efficacy. And those were big, controversial policies that a lot of people were hurt by, or a lot of people disagreed with and thought weren't well thought through. So it's good to have those examined. There are a number of other things around the pandemic and around the COVID response that aren't going to be looked into here. So it's not going to look into like the decisions of courts and tribunals. It's not going to look into Reserve Bank monetary policy. It's not going to look into various aspects of COVID epidemiology, so whether the public health professionals in the ministry were had their information right or were making good decisions about that stuff. And it's also, we need to get some clarity, I think, on whether a lot of New Zealanders felt their basic rights were violated during this period. You know, their right to go out and participate in society, their freedoms of association, their freedoms of protest, freedom of travel, freedom of movement. These were all, these are basic freedoms, and they were all compromised in some way by the pandemic management measures that were rolled out. Even Amnesty International complained at the time about Bill of Rights violations in the government's pandemic management. And there's never really been an accounting for that. The Bureau of Vetting of the Pandemic Management Bill, it didn't have appropriate Bureau of Vetting because they passed it so quickly. Bureau being a Bill of Rights Act vetting that you're required to do for legislation. So there's never really been an accounting for this violation, or what was felt to be at least a violation of Kiwis' basic rights. And that's something, it remains to be seen. It's not clearly articulated in the terms of reference, as far as I could see, that is going to be something that's looked into. So I hope there is a chance to look into that.
Yeah, hopefully the inquiry brings a lot of things into light, and that we'll be able to do something with that information when it comes out. And unfortunately, you can't have everything that you want. Unfortunately, you can't get everything looked into, especially when the government itself is doing these investigations. But this is a big step in the right direction. It's a big win, I believe, for Voices for Freedom, for Reality Check Radio, for all of the people who wanted to get some answers. There's at least a fair chance now to get answers on a few very important points of the lockdowns and the mandates and the COVID vaccines and decisions that were made there. And who knows, maybe there's an opportunity to have a crack at some of these other little bits and pieces in the future.
Well, let's hope so. I think you're right. Were it not for the organization, and were it not for the efforts of people associated with Reality Check Radio and the VFF community especially, we wouldn't have got this far. So I think
that's with the support of tens of thousands of ordinary New Zealanders. And it's always great to have this example where the people were able to make a bit of a difference, were able to work together and beat the odds, because I certainly wouldn't have thought of this a couple of years ago if you told me, yes, Voices for Freedom is going to successfully get a COVID inquiry amended to include looking into the mandates, the vaccines themselves, and the lockdowns. I would have told you that there was no chance in hell of that happening. But it happened, you know. Amazing, tireless work by a lot of these people. And I'm very, very proud of them.
Yeah, very good effort, very good work, and somewhat positive result.
And that is all that we have time for today on the weekly roundup. Please let us know if you enjoyed it. Let us know your thoughts. Text us on 2057 or email inbox@realitycheck.radio. And we should be back next week.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.